I want to introduce my first guest. Her name is Megan Lerner, and Megan Lerner is a social worker and a clinical coordinator at the Lurie Children Trauma Treatment Service at the Lurie Chicago Hospital, one of the top pediatric providers in the city. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here we go. Hi. So obviously we have all looked, watched this train wreck of a case of the 13 children, the Turpin family out of Paris, California, where the parents of these 13 children, ages somewhere between 2 and 29, were in a house basically imprisoned in a way and horribly mistreated from a standpoint of medical care, food, and the basic teachings for children. And you've watched this, and I guess I want to know, what kind of parents do this to their children? What do we know about them, and what can we say about who they are?
I mean, I think having never met, obviously, the Turpin family, I can't necessarily speak very articulately to what they actually have or are diagnosed with, but I think I can sort of postulate on some of the ideas. I think there is a history, as we've seen in the course of time, of the parents having their own abuse history, and not all people, I want to be very clear, that have a history of abuse go on to become abusers, but I do think that that can increase, and research sort of supports that it can increase the propensity for perpetuating abuse. And then I also know that there's been some discussion about the parents potentially being and participating in some pretty significant and constrictive religious practices that could have also brought to light some of this. I don't think we 100% understand why people do these things, but I think that ultimately the impact is what is going to be the real issue as we sort of move forward.
Now, when it comes to parents like this, are they people who at some point are going to say, wow, I did something wrong, I think I shouldn't have done this, the children are harmed, or are they going to perpetually think that what they did was proper parenting?
I hope that for the children's sake, they are able one day to accept responsibility for what they've done, because we know that the outcomes for the children's own health and wellness will be significantly improved if the parents can do that. I don't know that it's possible, because I don't know what is driving the parents' behavior.
Now, Megan, in your job with Lurie Children's Trauma Treatment and Service, What kind of kids do you see? What kind of abuse do you see? I mean, this is kind of at the extreme, I would imagine.
Absolutely. I think this is definitely an extreme, and fortunately it is an extreme given all of the things that, you know, have been sort of coming out in the media over time. We see a variety of different chief complaints and reasons for seeking service on our team. We're a multidisciplinary team. We have psychiatrists, we have psychologists, we have clinical social workers, and we also have trainees who work to help various forms of abuse. So we see physical abuse, sexual abuse. Because we are a hospital, we see medical trauma, which isn't necessarily intentional trauma, but kids going through chronic medical conditions and medical procedures can experience trauma as a result. We do see some of what this would be considered, which we would call complex trauma, which is multiple different types of trauma over the course of a significant period of time during development. And we see things from car accidents to natural disaster experiences, things like
and
that.
And I would imagine community violence is a big one as well.
Community violence is one of our biggest ones, which is one of the things that we're starting a really amazing and very exciting program surrounding.
Yeah. So let's take it from the children's standpoint. The children, some of them of whom are not children, they're
right.
Adult children, you have this group of 13. What is it that the therapist and the psychiatrist and the psychologist, what are they doing generally at this point in time?
At this point in time, I think it's a lot about assessment and about figuring out sort of where everyone is at and what the needs are. Having experienced what we call complex trauma, meaning trauma that started at the early on in childhood and then has sort of continued throughout the course of large developmental periods of time, this can have a dramatic impact not only on the kids' emotional well-being, but also on their physical well-being. And so I think you start first and foremost with the most critical experiences. So are there medical conditions that need immediate treatment? Are there thoughts of suicide or thoughts of homicide or things that are putting people's safety at immediate risk? And then I think from there, they're looking at, okay, how do we meet the needs over a longer term? You can't actually be diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD, which is what I think everybody is thinking that these children probably have, immediately. There is a period of time after the abuse stops where that is something that you would be calling an acute stress disorder if you're using the medical diagnostic manual, because there is this period where with abuse, not everybody that experiences a trauma, whether it is abuse or not, automatically has trauma symptoms. Now, I would be remiss to say that there's probably not a kid in this family that isn't experiencing trauma symptoms, given the chronicity and the intensity of what we're sort of hearing. But the child brain is a really resilient concept, and there is the potential for healing within the child brain without necessarily a ton of intervention.
We're talking to Megan Lerner from Lori Children's Hospital, and we're talking about the horrible case of the 13 children found in Paris, California, on WGN. So are they trying to keep these children together? I mean, if there's two or three children, that might be something easy. But when you have 13 children with a span of ages, I would imagine that finding foster care would be very difficult.
And I would imagine also the complex needs of the children are probably pretty ranging. One of the things that we know that kids who have experienced chronic abuse and kids who have experienced abuse within that 0 to 5, 0 to 6 range, especially, can really demonstrate significant physiological changes and medical conditions. So I would, my educated guess would be that each of those kids has some pretty significant and special needs in some capacity.
We clearly have malnutrition.
Sure.
I mean, we had an adult child who was 80-something pounds. So we know that those children are now being fed and hopefully on a program to get them healthy that way. We also know that their medical needs were, I would say, to say they're neglected is an understatement.
Sure.
Because some of them probably never saw a doctor. They didn't know how to brush their teeth. They didn't know what medicine was. So
yes.
I would assume that there are going to be ongoing physical examinations. But you told me something interesting off the microphone, that I asked you the question about if a child is neglected in the first, say, 6 months to maybe 2 years of their lives, how does that affect them? Because they would never remember that. They would
right.
never remember that mom wasn't there or that they didn't get their feedings regularly. So is there some idea from all this research that has been done as to whether or not there is some long-term effect for that kind of neglect?
Absolutely. There's a lot of great research being done about that 0 to 5 community. One of the things that we know, and when I keep talking about these physiological changes, is we know that kids who live in orphanages, who have a strict feeding schedule and a strict changing schedule and limited human interaction, their brains actually do not develop to the same size
wow.
as children who are getting regular care from their parents. And that's a study that Bruce Perry, who is a medical doctor and one of the leading voices out there about that early childhood neglect and abuse, discusses pretty frequently. I think, yes, you don't have the traditional, and this is one of the things we also talked about. I don't think you have the traditional memories of, I wasn't getting fed when I want to, but you're getting reinforcement from the world that the people that are supposed to keep me safe and take care of me aren't doing that. And even if I express that I have a need, the adults in the world aren't meeting that need. And so then you learn to distrust the world.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. Megan Lerner, we're going to take a break here. And if you have any comments or questions on this issue or any issue relating to child abuse and neglect, 312-981-7200. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show. Welcome back. We're talking to Megan Lerner about child abuse and neglect. And I guess this issue of these children not being, into this world, they haven't really been exposed to things. They haven't been exposed to simple things. Like, I think one of them was asked, to you something about a police officer, and they didn't know what a police officer was, which reminds me of that movie and the book that I read called Room. Did you happen to read that book?
I didn't read the book. I did see the movie.
And if anyone out there doesn't know what that is, it's about a woman who's actually kept captive by an evil man, and she gives birth in this room, and she keeps her child in the room to a, you know, maybe 6, 7, 8 years old, and then finally gets released. That's a spoiler alert. But it's interesting because the remaining part of the movie talks about the development of a child who's never been exposed to anything real outside of this single room. And it reminds me of what these kids are going to be up against. Tell me, what is the process of trying to integrate the children into the real world?
That is a very complex question. I think ultimately the key piece is really trying to figure out where each of the children are at and then meeting them where their children are at accordingly, right? So having and building a structure around the children that teaches them that the world is a safe place and that the world isn't as scary as they probably were conditioned to believe over the course of time in sort of being in that house. I think the other thing that's important to remember is that these kids were, yes, locked in the house, but they were locked in the house, but then they also were taken out. We see all these pictures of them at Disney World, and we see pictures of them in Las Vegas. You know, I think with abuse and with interfamilial abuse, there is an extra level of complexity because we are taught intrinsically that we are supposed to love our parents. And so I believe that there's a hard road ahead of these kids because they're going to have to sort of learn to manage the good memories that they have with their parents with the reality of the fact that their parents weren't people that could keep them safe and take care of them.
And it's a fascinating phenomenon. Even in the family law where I practice, you do see children who have been abused by their parents and they still love them dearly and they still want a relationship with them. However, in this case, I saw this past week that there was an order of protection entered against the parents for a 3-year period, which doesn't mean it necessarily is lifted. It means that it would have to be renewed in 3 years, that the parents have no contact whatsoever with those children. I don't know that the defense attorney objected. I think he was on board to say it probably protects both parties to this issue. Is there a point in time that you could ever imagine? I know you're looking into a
crystal ball.
That you know, but is it possible that these children should, from a therapeutic standpoint, see their parents again for one reason or another, to either hold them accountable or to see them and talk to them? What would be your thought on that?
I think ultimately if the parents aren't going to accept responsibility for what they did, that may be tricky, an idea of reunification. Reunification in and of itself is sort of its own sect in the mental health world, and people are doing this job sort of independently of trauma-focused work, which is what we're doing at Lurie. So I would say I'm not an expert in reunification for sure, but I would say when thinking about the families that I've worked with where a parent has been a perpetrator or a familial contact has been part of the perpetration of victimization against a kid, one of the things that we really try to do is try to not bring that other person in until the victim feels an increased sense of control. I think one of the things that abuse does sort of knowingly, and one of the things that all of my patients really speak to me about, is that loss of control that happens. And this is sort of an extra layer because it's a loss of control at a time when you don't have a lot of control anyway because you're a child and you look to your parents to help teach you how to function in the world and to say, this is good and this is bad. And their parents sort of did the exact opposite of that.
If you have any comments or questions for Megan or for me, 312-981-7200 or text to the same number. We have a texter from the 630 who asks, what protections are there in the state of Illinois to prevent this kind of thing from happening here? Can you speak to that? And again, and also within the same topic is, if you see something, if you, you know, it seems to me and seems to everybody that something should have been noticed and reported here, and maybe it was, and we don't know that.
Sure.
But, you know, along those terms, who should have been seeing this, and what can a person do if they see something that's unusual?
I think the difference, and I can really only speak to the state of Illinois, right? Just that is where I'm practicing. So in the state of Illinois, the thing that we have that sort of takes care of all children is the Department of Children and Family Services, or DCFS. They have a 1-800 number, and it's 1-800-25-ABUSE. Anybody can call with any concern at any time. You can also call and ask for what's called a child welfare check, which is basically requesting that somebody go out and talk with the family and offer them potential services because you have a concern. The thing about that is that it is a voluntary program, and so if the family chooses not to engage in that and the DCFS worker does not see anything that's concerning in the doorway, there's really nothing they can do.
But it's a step. It's something that
absolutely.
You can do.
And then you can also always call 911. You can always call 311. And you can ask the police to go and do a welfare check as well.
And they're probably a little more aggressive in going in than are the DCFS.
They do not have the same rules as DCFS. No.
So just really bullet point. What are the things that somebody, an outsider, a neighbor, a teacher, maybe a parent of a child, who's playing with the child who has some issues. What would you see in someone who is neglected or abused?
So one of the things that they really talk about in this case is that when the children were going to school, they were very dirty. They smelled. They were not well cared for. I think especially in young children, if you're seeing that and it's becoming sort of a common or an everyday thing, or is something that the kid is getting teased about, that's certainly a red flag. If you see a kid who sort of looks withdrawn or despondent or is particularly tired, that can be a red flag. The problem is that everything that I'm currently describing can also just be a kid.
Right.
Right?
A teenager with some hygiene issues.
Oh my gosh, how many times do I sit in my office and say, we have to take a shower. Deodorant is our friend. Right? Like, I think that there is some, like, people are hoping that there is like some gold star that these people will wear and we can just see and intervene immediately. And that's just not a realistic expectation. My gut, my report, and when I'm teaching people how to do this work, I'm saying if you're concerned, try to figure out what the concern is, and if it feels like a legitimate concern, it's always better to overcall than undercall.
Megan, we're talking about the case of the 13 children in California, but as I'm talking, just real briefly, and we're going to maybe come back in a little bit, but just can you give me just a brief insight as to what you think in the Nassar sentencing case when you had 160 young women come and talk? Was that a good thing for them from your standpoint, from knowing what abusers go through? Is this something that's positive for them?
Absolutely. When we do all sorts of interventions at the hospital, one of the main frameworks we work for is called trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. And the big punch in TFCBT, as they call it, is doing what's called a trauma narrative, which is really helping the victim tell their story in a way that puts the power back to them. And I have had the privilege of participating in that experience with many different types of trauma and many different patients. And every single time, every one of my patients has said, I really hated when you made me do that, but it really helped.
And I've been reading about how the girls and women were actually formulating their victim impact statements and what they wanted to do. And they wanted to tell the world. They wanted to tell others. They wanted to tell the judge. They wanted to confront their perpetrators. So there were multiple reasons for them doing it. And they seemed like, although obviously very heart-wrenching, very positive after it was over.
And for so long, those poor girls were silenced, right? They were telling people and people weren't believing them. This man who gets the sort of implicit trust we give doctors, right? We assume that when we go to a doctor, that's a safe person. We teach our children, you don't have to worry. We're going to the doctor. The doctor's allowed to look at you in your private areas. The doctor is a safe place to go to be around those things. And, you know, some of the testimony reported that he was doing this in front of people's parents.
Absolutely.
So I think that it probably was a very empowering experience. And I think as just an audience member, it was a very empowering thing to watch.
Megan Lerner, I want to thank you for joining us. Our time just flew. Megan Lerner is with Lurie Children's Trauma Treatment Service. If anyone wants to get a hold of you, how would they contact you?
So the best way to get a hold of me is probably going through the hospital as a whole. And you can reach out to Lurie Children's Hospital. The main number is 312-227-227. 4,000, and that would probably be the best way to go about kind of getting connected to us and to the wonderful service and the wonderful team that I'm just so lucky to be a part of.
They do great work. Megan Lawrence, thank you very much, and we wish those children the best. I'm sure everyone else does. You're listening to WGN on the Karen Conti Show.